welcome to Season 1, Episode 4 of the Ohio Star Podcast. I'm your host, Neil W. McCabe, the national political editor of the Star News Network, a collection of 10 state-focused news sites, including the Ohio Star. In today's episode, you will hear from Star reporter Peter DeBrasca, and he will talk about the COVID numbers in Ohio and what it has been like for him to deal with the Ohio Health Department. Next up is Mount Vernon attorney Scott A. Pullins, who is a GOP candidate for state representative and the attorney of record for the five members of the Ohio Republican Central Committee who are suing party chairman Robert Paduchek and the party. Scott talks about the lawsuit and the stalled out redistricting process and how that's playing out for him and other candidates. Finally, you'll hear Republican State Representative DJ Swearingen. He represents Ohio's 89th House District. This district is east of Toledo, along Lake Erie, but not quite halfway to Cleveland. This is a classic Ohio Obama-Trump district, and DJ will put some flesh on that bone. Today's podcast is brought to you by Proclaiming Justice to the Nations and their Taking Back America's Children seminar held February 12th and 13th in Orlando, Florida. With more details, here's the editor-in-chief of the Star News Network, Michael Patrick Leahy.
This is Michael Patrick Leahy. Are you, like me, concerned with what's happening in classrooms across America? If you are, there's an event coming up in Florida you really should consider attending. It's called Taking Back America's Children and is presented by Proclaiming Justice to the Nations. This power-packed seminar will effectively educate, motivate, and equip parents and patriots alike with the strategies needed to reclaim America's classrooms. Taking Back America's Children will be held Saturday and Sunday, February 12th and 13th in Orlando, Florida. Get your tickets now at pjtn.org. That's pjtn.org. Speakers include Lori Cardoza Moore, founder of Proclaiming Justice to the Nations, Stephanie Meyer, author of The Righteous Fight, Reclaiming the Soul of America, and Matt Staver, author of Take Back America. Get your tickets now at pjtn.org. pjtn.org.
Thank you, Michael. And now here's my conversation with the great Peter DeBrasca. Peter, how are you?
Oh, better than I deserve, Neil. Thank you. Good to be here.
Yes, you are better than you deserve.
Oh, man. Well, you taught me everything I know. You know, going back
there you go. Yeah.
5 days ago.
So, yeah, just tell that to the judge. It's that and Your Honor, it started as a quiet evening at home.
Yeah. I'll take note of that.
Yeah. Someone put on some music and one thing led to another. So there you go. So you know, we talked before about Ohio's COVID numbers and obviously, the Wuhan flu, and there's so many mysteries around what happened at the lab and, you know, what the government knew and what it didn't know. And, you know, while people are spending millions of dollars trying to figure out what's going on, there's a handful of people at the top who knew exactly what was going on. Like Dr. Anthony Fauci never spoke up, you know, and said, hey, we did fund this gain of function research with the Chinese to make a virus that was harmless to humans completely and absolutely lethal to humans as we designed it to attack the human lungs.
So he actively concealed it. He lied to Congress about it.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, well, it would have been helpful, right, to know. But another thing that's come, you know, now that we're into what, I guess, year three of COVID-ness. Is it year three? Has it been 2 years of COVID? Yeah, it's been 2 years of COVID, so we're in our third year. You know, you're trying to get some hard numbers of what's actually going on and to try to understand the progress of this disease in Ohio, and you've been dealing with the Ohio Department of Health. And so straight up, how would you characterize your interaction with the Ohio Department of Health when it comes to your questions about COVID?
But it's just an utter lack of transparency. And it's not even that they won't return my inquiries. It's that they do return my inquiries, and every single time I have dealt with them, Neil, no joke, every single time I have sent a question to the Ohio Department of Health, they have responded by declining to comment. They absolutely refuse to answer questions. And to give you an example of the types of stories I've been working on, and I know that the people of Ohio really like these stories, so I'm trying to do at least one of them a week. We've been talking about numbers. So, you know, most recently for the Omicron variant, obviously we have, you know, this massive wave of cases, right? But when it comes to deaths, the 7-day death average in Ohio is pretty much the same as it was during the Delta variant. It's nowhere near the level that it was at this time last year, which was sort of the major peak of the entire virus. So I've been trying to essentially gauge where the Ohio Department of Health thinks we are at with this virus. It seems that Omicron should be the absolute end of the pandemic, considering that so many people have gotten it and it's less mild. And this is, you know, according to like every scientific piece of information ever written about viruses, this is how it works, right? They mutate over and over again until they become, extremely, extremely mild, but they are spread very easily among the population, just like the flu. Now, I'm not a doctor, and, you know, we're told we have to follow the science, right, regardless of whether it goes in circles or anywhere else. And so I've been seeking clarification on these things, and I've asked specific questions like, hey, you know, can you tell me even if Omicron has peaked, right? Your data shows the case numbers on average every week plummeting. So does that mean it's peaked? I mean, when can we say it's peaked, right? When can we say the pandemic has turned endemic? These kind of questions. And every single time the Ohio Department of Health has declined to comment when I ask these questions. And then further, the Ohio Department of Health is giving quotes to all these other news outlets, right? Of course, who are essentially just PR firms for them and for powerful people. And instead of asking the serious questions, they just
right.
go ahead and print whatever, you know, the ODH says as fact. And you know, without any kind of skeptical anything. And I think it's an embarrassment. I think I finally got to the point with the Ohio Department of Health last week, Neil, where I responded very politely. You know, I said to the guy, I said, look, man, no disrespect, but every single time I've asked you for a comment, you've declined. And this has been going on for 6 months, and I've sent you probably, you know, a dozen inquiries at least. And I asked him, I said, you know, don't the people of Ohio, like, deserve to know the answers to these questions? Like, you work for them, right? They pay your salary. Our readers want to know this. And, you know, in typical fashion, we declined to comment. I mean, like, totally unbelievable. So just silence all around and absolute lack of transparency.
Well, there is, there's different kinds of reporter. And there's a beat reporter. And so I think the problem you're running into is there are reporters who are assigned to this story who are working it like a beat. And so with a beat reporter, you exchange, you know, access for basically playing by ground rules by saying, hey, I'm not going to blow you up. Whereas you're kind of like, you're like this roving hitman, right? Just sort of scurrying the country. And so like the guy who rides on the bus with the New York Yankees is not going to write an article that blows up the New York Yankees. Because he'll get thrown off the bus. The guy who flies in for 3 days from Sports Illustrated, he will blow up the Yankees because he doesn't care, right? He just moves on. And so that's the problem, you know, where you try to develop a relationship. And then what happens is these guys all become friends. And it then becomes a club. And then you got, you know, you got you, Peter, right? Knocking on the door, you know, with your pre-dawn raid, trying to find out what's going on. And they're like, who are you? Why are you being so troublesome? Why are you always annoying us with ridiculous questions? What is wrong with you? Go ahead.
So there's two points about that. One, the first thing they teach you in confrontational politics is that access is the opposite of power when it comes to politics, right? So if you have access, you have no power. You have to give up all your power to get access, which is exactly what you're talking about. And secondly, you know, I think that I'm doing what journalists used to do consistently. Journalists used to be skeptical of big, powerful organizations, and they used to regularly ask them serious questions. And it used to be normal for those organizations to respond to those serious questions, or at least to have to respond in some way, even if they gave a nonsense non-answer. Now, anybody who asks any serious question of any government entity or even big company or anybody like that who has power is simply dismissed. And it's bad for our society. It's bad for regular people. And I think that, you know, these people, especially the people whose salaries we pay, need to start answering to us more than they are currently.
What have you seen in the Ohio numbers? And, you know, where do you think it's going? And what answer do you think they should, you know, if you were to guess, you know, where COVID is going in Ohio, where would you put it?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that Omicron has peaked. I think it peaked, you know, 2 weeks ago at least. I think that the reason why the Ohio Department of Health does not want to answer my questions specifically, other than the fact that I've been pestering them, and that they're probably annoyed by me, which I'm fine with, for the record, is because they don't want to be the first people to declare that we're safe from the pandemic. See, nobody wants to do that at any level of government in, you know, in any sector, whether it's like health or administration or, you know, whoever the group might be, because, you know, they feel like they could be wrong about that. Or frankly, I think that they're so invested in the COVID pandemic that they just don't want it to be over. I mean, Anthony Fauci doesn't have any reason to want COVID to be over. He doesn't want his 15 minutes of fame to be up. And so, you know, this is a problem we're running into. They know that it's over. They know that it's about to be finished. They know that this is the last wave. A few doctors have come out and said it. I mean, you can kind of look up these reports. But the people in power don't want to admit it. And I don't expect them, frankly, to admit it. I don't know how long they're going to keep the charade up. It could go literally forever. So I think it's over. I just think that people are afraid and do not want to be the first groups to say it's over. They're also still pushing vaccines, of course. And so they come out and say, well, it's over. You know, people who are already hesitant to take the vaccine are going to look at them and say, well, you just said it's over. Why should I take your vaccine? Right. So, I just think it's a case of feet dragging until some other authority says it's safe for you to say these things about the pandemic. And everybody's looking at everybody else wondering when that's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they had a good run, you know.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like the TV weathermen in Boston, you know, when spring comes, you know, and they just have to go back to regular weather. They're no longer running, you know, the storm center, you know, you know, it's like where the top of the news is this blizzard and all the kids want to hear you tell them that their school is closed. And then spring comes, winter's over, and you have to go, you know, and the weatherman is back to the end of the newscast. He's no longer top of the newscast anymore.
The scientists are going to have to go back to arguing over whether Pluto is a planet, and they don't want to do that, it seems like.
So there is a billionaire, I guess, patriot, Peter Thiel, who has done a lot of very positive things, I think, for democracy and for the economy, and just as an intellectual about he's weighed in on journalism and democracy, and, you know, he's just this Renaissance man, and he announced that he's leaving the board of Facebook, which he was one of the original seed money or funders of Facebook. He was on the board of directors up until, I guess, this week. And he's leaving. But he owns Rumble, or he's part of the team that runs Rumble. And, of course, Rumble was in the news with Joe Rogan. So what do you think's going on with Joe Rogan, big tech, and how do you think things are shaking out in that sort of sphere?
Well, this is it's kind of an amazing story. Joe Rogan is seemingly uncancelable. The news came out this week, and keep in mind, we have to look at this from a perspective of what happened before the most recent news, right? So the backdrop is he's had all these non-mainstream, quote-unquote, guests on his show about, COVID-19, including Dr. Malone, the guy who invented the mRNA vaccine technology and now says that technology is unsafe. And, Rogan's caught a lot of flack for the people he's had on his show discussing COVID, despite the fact that he's never been praised for having CNN's chief medical correspondent on to discuss, his side of the story, right? Sanjay Gupta is the name of that guy. And so Rogan's been catching a lot of flack, and then there were some episodes in the past, and Joe Rogan has thousands of podcast episodes.
Like more than 100, more than 100 episodes deleted.
Right. And so there's two interesting things about this. I mean, the racial slur controversy is there. Normally that's plenty to get somebody canceled for life forever, right? See you later. We'll never hear from you again. But, I think the two interesting points about this are that Spotify absolutely knew those episodes existed before they gave Joe Rogan $100 million in a contract to exclusively stream on Spotify. They absolutely knew those episodes existed. There is no way that they did not have employees comb over every single episode. So that means in the beginning, they chose to keep those episodes in order to at least appear as though they weren't going to censor Joe Rogan. Secondly, the CEO of the company Sunday sent a memo to employees that said that Joe Rogan actually decided for himself to pull the episodes and that the company didn't force him to do so. Whether that's true or just, PR is I mean,
they only put a gun to his head.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But then Rumble comes in and Rumble says, well, hey Joe, we're never going to make you delete any episodes. And oh, by the way, we'll give you $100 million over 4 years. You'll make the exact same amount of money that Spotify gave you if you come and do your show on our platform exclusively. Now, there's been no response from Rogan, and maybe it was kind of just a troll. They said it was a legitimate offer. Maybe it was just, kind of to point the finger at Spotify and say, hey, look, you guys are engaging in this type of cancel culture. You can't fully cancel Joe Rogan because you have to protect your $100 million investment. We know what's going on here. But they did a good job of kind of, putting the heat on Spotify for a second there. The other thing that the CEO said in his Sunday memo was that silencing Joe is not the answer, which I found particularly interesting because there's other people that they have silenced. But it seems like there's an inconsistent application of the rules here. Not that we're advocating for big tech to silence anybody, but it just seems that they're working really hard to protect their $100 million investment.
Yeah, and from what I understand, I saw a comment by Rogan, and he can speak for himself, but from what I understand, when he was using the N-word, he was doing it, as we say, academically. And right. he was not actually using the accusative declension, the accusative case to say something, someone to address it as a person, but he was saying the term as people were discussing it, its usage and whatnot. He was using it in that sort of the context of the discussion. If they were talking about turtles, he wouldn't say the T word. He would actually say turtle. And that didn't mean he was accusing someone of being a turtle. And he said that, when he was younger, he thought that was fine. But as he matured, he realized that that was also unacceptable. And so he stopped the practice. But, I don't think there's anyone who said that his intent was racist or you know, he didn't use it as the epithet.
Right. Well, so I think the far left is intentionally making an argument that has no nuance, which is a tactic that they use all the time, right? And they're just sort of making a broad, well, Joe Rogan's a racist because he used the N-word thing, right? To make you think that he was saying it in a derogatory manner, which of course he wasn't. The very idea that Joe Rogan is a racist is absolutely insane, right? I mean, in his thousands of podcasts, he's had all kinds of different people on his show, all of varying political viewpoints and varying occupations and just people from all different walks of life. And that's what this is a war on. It's not a war on racism, because Joe Rogan is obviously not a racist. It is a war on like free conversation and open discussion, because the left is just an authoritarian group that wants to silence free discussion and free debate, because they do not want to live in a free society. They want to control everything. And Joe Rogan is the biggest threat to that right now. You know, who would have thought the Fear Factor guy would be striking so much fear in the heart of liberals? But here we are.
Right. It's right next to your copy of the Federalist Papers would be this bowl of insects that he wants you to eat.
Yeah, that's right. It's a crazy time that we live in. And I think that I don't think we're headed in the right direction with it. Honestly, I think that we're moving towards more censorship, and that's not going to be good for anybody. You know, the key to combating bad ideas is to be able to refute those bad ideas. It's not to silence the bad ideas. Then the bad ideas will just go underground where they can talk, and they will keep flourishing and they will grow, and people will adopt the bad ideas.
There used to be the marketplace of ideas, which is what everyone used to talk about. And so, you know, it's rather than there is no, you know, absolute truth, it's just this competing flow of ideas. And so like when you go into a courtroom, you know, you have the prosecution and you have the defense, and you sort of throw your narratives at each other, and a jury or a judge sort of decides, but this competition of ideas is what's so important. And when you basically see certain ideas are just like off the field, they don't go away. It's just that because they're just not addressed. Nobody knocks. They might be terrible ideas, but when you just suppress them, they continue to linger unchallenged. So, well, Peter, thank you very much for joining the Ohio Star podcast this week. I think people can look forward to maybe you'll get some trucking stories in. I think Canada has some, the Canadian truckers, and they border Ohio, they border Michigan, they border Minnesota. So we'll get suns.
They are just outside of our lane, but I think that we will be able to get some stories in on those. Very interesting situation. State of emergency.
Yeah. Yes, state of emergency. All right, then. Thanks a lot, Peter. Be good.
All right. Thanks, Neil.
Scott A. Pullins is a busy man, which is a good thing. I caught up with him after the state Supreme Court tossed out the most recent attempt to draw the new district lines, and we talked about the situation brewing inside the Ohio Republican Party. Here's my conversation with attorney Scott A. Pullins. Scott, how's it going? Thanks for being with us.
I'm doing great, Neil. Thanks for having me on.
Well, Scott, you have a lot on your plate. I know that you're very active in a lot of things, and I want to we'll get to all of them. But first and foremost, you are a candidate for state representative, and your candidacy, along with, I'm imagining, hundreds of other people, is kind of in flux now because what's going on with redistricting. So what is the state of play right now with Ohio redistricting for the state legislature, and then if you want to weigh in on the national stuff of the House side, go ahead.
Sure, they've really created a mess. The Supreme Court has now ruled unconstitutional the state legislative districts two times. And now it's back to the drawing board from what their opinion said. And they've given the legislature, well, the redistricting commission, just 10 days, including weekends, to come back with a third plan. In the meantime, you know, there's 99 House districts. There's 33 Senate districts, although not all of them run every year, every two to four years. So there are a lot of candidates that have collected signatures. They paid their filing fees. They're ordering literatures. They're out knocking on doors, and everything's kind of been upended at this point. And then on the congressional side, the legislature basically decided that they couldn't get enough votes for a plan to have it go into effect immediately, so they kicked it back to the redistricting commission. So the commission will have its second try on the congressional seats while at the same time it's working under a tight deadline for their third try at the legislative seats.
Yeah, it's got to be crazy and frustrating, you know, because most of these candidates are collecting their signatures, right, in the dead of winter. It's like, I imagine some places have more snow than others, but basically the whole state of Ohio experiences a decent winter. So, I mean, how did you go about collecting your signatures to sort of mitigate the risk that you might be collecting signatures that don't actually belong to your district?
Yeah, the most likely district we'll end up with would include all of Knox County, which is where I'm from. So what I did is I just collected signatures from Knox County residents. The legislature put in some quick last-minute changes that allow you to have some flexibility in case they split the districts one way or the other. So essentially, if you collect them, collect your signatures from one county, and that county, you know, ends up being in the new district, all those signatures will count. But you know, it's hard to say what could happen at this point, what the court could say, and that's pretty much why I've come out and said, hey, let's take this to the U.S. Supreme Court and see if we can get them to weigh in on it, and at the same time, let's move the primary to either July or August of this year.
And have people at the state house sort of given you the signal that that's where they're going to, what they were going to end up doing?
Well, only the legislature can move it, and they haven't been real excited about moving the primary. However, Secretary of State Frank LaRose came out today and said he's concerned that his folks won't have time to properly conduct the election. So he's talking about moving the primary. I think if the Secretary of State comes out definitively and says, look, we need to move the primary, we don't have enough time to do all the things that have to be done, including a lot of, there are federal requirements which require them to send out notices closer to the primary election, especially for related to military and overseas voters. And if the districts aren't decided yet, you can't send out the notices. And those are federal requirements. So the only solution there would be to move the primary to later in this year.
Now, there are different parts of your practice, but a major part of your practice for many years is campaign law, campaign finance law. Why are the Democrats so much better than the Republicans? Because when you go to states like, you look at states like Maryland or New York, or where I grew up in Massachusetts, the Democrats basically draw whatever districts they want, no matter how crazy. I knew a guy, he was a state senator, Jarrett Barrios. He was a state senator from Cambridge, and he was on the redistricting committee on the state Senate side in Massachusetts. He drew a line down this street, right down the middle of the street. And at the end of the street, he circled one house at the end of the street. And then the district went back up. So basically,
yeah,
that one house was in the district, and he did it deliberately because Eldridge Gerry, for whom the gerrymander was named, that was his house in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the state senator did it as an homage to Eldridge Gerry to make the most outrageous sort of district possible. But
yep.
But golly, the Democrats are so good. They get you. It's every Republican. The Republicans are always tied up in court, and the Democrats just do whatever they want. Why?
Well, Democrats, they fight, and they fight to win. Part of the problem that we're in now is because back when these constitutional amendments were passed, starting in 2015, a lot of Republicans got on board with the Democrats, and I guess they assumed that we would always have a strong majority on the Supreme Court. You know, we would always be able to elect statewide officials to the redistricting commission. So a lot of them got on board. In fact, the original sponsor of the 2015 amendment, which is the legislative side, was Matt Huffman, who was in the House then, who's now the Senate president. And, of course, Vernon Sykes, who's in the Senate now. They're both on the redistricting commission, but it was really a big coalition of left-wing groups that went out and co-opted Republicans and some traditional Republican groups, got them on board and passed this thing, and it's turned into a real mess.
Is there any kind of standard that of what a district should look like? Because I've been told that the Democrats are saying that the district should be like 55-45. But that's just as arbitrary as anything else. I mean, who came up with that? And why does a district have to be drawn Democrat Republican? Why can't you draw the line, the districts based on pro life, pro choice, pro gun, anti gun? You know, because you could almost pick any issue to draw a district.
Exactly.
The Constitution basically says that the legislature is supposed to draw the district. Obviously, you have a constitutional amendment in Ohio, but is there any arbitrary standard, or concrete standard that says the district must be this proportionally?
There are some standards. The big one they're relying upon is there's a provision that says we take the average for the last 10 years of statewide elections. And then we average that, you know, how many people voted for Republicans, how many voted for Democrats, and then come up with an average. And then that's the average we should, that's how we're getting the 54-46 or the 55-45 districts. But, you know, it's not like people go to the ballot and statewide and say, oh, I'm going to go vote for the Republican, even though some of them do. You know, the same folks that reelected or elected and won Ohio for Donald Trump in 16 and 20 also reelected Sherrod Brown in 2018.
Well, there are districts in Ohio that are, you know, Obama, Trump districts.
Exactly.
And there are Republicans who voted for Romney who will never vote Republican again.
Exactly.
And there are inner city districts. Like if you take a Cleveland district, that's 55-45 Republican. Is it, they're going to make every district 55-45?
No, I mean, what they're looking for is an overall. So, you know, you have the 99 House seats, 33 Senate seats. They're trying to get to 54-46 in the House and 18-15 in the Senate. But the problem is to get to that figure, you have to go and really gerrymander in a Democrat direction. Because the fact is you look at most of the counties in Ohio are rural. Democrats only have support in and around the six big cities. So you have some, to get to 55-45, you're going to get some really crazy drawn districts.
Yeah, they look like the they're like these are ink blot districts.
Yes. And really that was the point, you know, they wanted the districts to be compact, they wanted them to be communities of interest, meaning, you know, a suburb of Columbus isn't necessarily like the city of Mount Vernon, for example. But yeah, the problem is when they start saying, well, it has to be 55-45 or it has to be 18-15, to get there, you're going to have to draw some really screwed up districts.
Yeah. Well, it really is a mess. And I also want to talk to you about the what's going on with the Republican Party of Ohio State Central Committee. The meeting was scheduled for, what, the 3rd? And then it was
the fourth,
right?
The fourth, yeah.
And it was postponed, I guess, because of snow. And then it's been rescheduled for, I believe, the 18th of February.
That's correct.
At that meeting at the 18th, one, will you be there? Two, do you expect the Central Committee to endorse Michael DeWine for governor?
I'm going to try to be there. At this point, they have shut the doors to the public. They have forbidden any members of the public coming unless they're invited guests or a candidate of some kind, you know, which is in direct violation of the bylaws once again. You know, they had a meeting a month or two ago where some folks were shouting and stuff like that. Well, if you're going to disrupt the public meeting, it's not that difficult to have those people removed. You don't remove the public. You don't remove people in violation of bylaws.
No, I was there. The
yeah.
Chairman Robert A. Pudicek, he ordered the public gallery cleared, and you had two deputy sheriffs who basically got strong on people, and there was one woman who was pleading with them. He says, I'm an invited guest. I'm not here as a member of the public. I was actually invited by one of the committee members. I'm an official guest.
Right.
And as the deputies were trying to figure out who they got to toss out and who they keep, Pudicek basically then gaveled the meeting shut before the agenda was even finished.
Yeah, I mean, in the past, the Ohio Republican Party has closed portions of the meeting. They can vote to go into executive session, but they can't close it to the public like that. You know, I was 4 years ago, I was at the endorsement meeting back in 2018 when Mike DeWine was endorsed the last time. You know, Mary Taylor was there. She got to speak. And the Senate candidates were there. They all got to speak. You know, it was an open process. The public was permitted there. There weren't any problems. You know, like I said, if people are being disruptive, the disruptive people can be removed. But other than that, they should not close the meeting to the public. This is too important.
And the endorsement of DeWine, you think that's a foregone conclusion?
I don't know yet. You know, I know the vote will be pretty close. The other thing that the Bob Pudicek is doing is he's refusing to permit roll call votes, which, again, the bylaws don't mention roll call votes, but the bylaws do state that in the meetings will be conducted pursuant to Robert's Rules of Order, which certainly permit roll call votes. I've talked to past state central committee members, and they remember making roll call votes over the years lots of times. Real problem right now is Bob Pudicek is running the party like a tyrant. You know, he's gaveling people down. He's not letting people participate. He's shutting out the public. And, you know, he's governing the party like a tyrant. And this is the wrong election year to be doing that.
I spoke to people also who told me, I wrote about this. I was at that meeting, and There are people who told me directly that before Chairman Poduchek came onto the scene, they had roll call votes all the time. And the bylaws basically say, if the bylaws are silent, then you rely on Robert's rules. And the reason you do that is so there's no reason for to every organization in the country to reinvent the wheel. And so everybody, whether you're at the Elks or, you know, or student senate at Ohio State University, you use Robert's rules. And, you know, even when there was some question on to a voice vote that obviously the Poduchek position on the voice vote lost, even though he declared it, you know, that he had won because they were trying to table one of the sort of rebel alliance motions that were on the agenda, and they divided the House. And they had, right. You know, and so are divided the House, is that in the bylaws? I mean, it's just like it seemed like he invented it. And so, but when you divide the House, you basically just have people go to one side of the room or the other, but there is no names.
Right.
And so nobody had to put their name on the fact that they were blocking an audit of the Ohio Republican Party.
Yeah, and that's important because every member of the state central committee is elected in the primary election. And, you know, they should have their votes on the record and because they have to answer to voters. And voters have a right to know how they're voting on these issues. And they're trying really hard. The party's trying real hard to shut everything down, to only endorse the incumbents and to just cram this down people's throats. And like I said, this is the wrong election year to be doing these dictatorial tactics.
Well, let me ask you this, because in full disclosure, you are the attorney of record now for the lawsuit filed by Mark Bainbridge and other members of the Central Committee, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And so what is the state of play of that lawsuit now? And why do you think these guys just reached the point where they had to file a lawsuit to actually sue the state committee and the chairman?
Yeah, the state of the case at this point is the initial complaint was filed by other counsel. And then during the process, the group decided to look for someone else, and they conducted quite a few interviews, and they ended up hiring me, mostly because I had a pretty good background and history of campaign finance issues and laws and litigating around nonprofit organizations and things like that. I got some additional time. When I entered the case, the defendants with their big Columbus law firms, of course, they filed a motion to dismiss. I've replied to that. They've responded to me then, and now I'm in the process of filing an amended complaint that just slims the complaint down a little bit and ask the court to look at a different statute than was originally pled in the original complaint. The folks that brought this suit tried to work within the process. You know, they've asked for meetings with the chairman and he won't return the calls or he won't meet with them. When they complain about things, he stripped them off of committees. Contrary to the process that's in place. They put resolutions on the floor, and those resolutions didn't get voted on because he gaveled the meeting closed. So really, they're at a point where if they wanted the party to operate in a lawful, fair manner, they had no choice other than to file suit.
It was kind of third world. I only went to that one central committee meeting in December, and I kind of have a skepticism, a natural skepticism.
Sure.
You know, I've been a reporter for about 20 years, and, you know, local, I covered local stuff in Boston, Cambridge, and Somerville. I've been on Capitol Hill. I've done various things, and, You know, a lot of times when somebody tells you a story that just seems so crazy, it turns out that like half of it's true, right? Because they're
right.
They're omitting the other side of the story. They're not giving you the other context. And so I went into the Central Committee meeting really with the idea that I was trying to triangulate to see, all right, where is this really set? Why are these rebel guys so crazy and angry? Because I spoke to Chairman Paduchek for about, I don't know, 30 minutes when I first joined Star News Network, and I was going to be focusing on Ohio. And he seemed like a very, very nice guy, very compelling. I spoke to Trish McLaughlin, the comms director, and she's wonderful. She's, you know, she does a great job, and she does what she does. And, you know, we knew some of the same people because she had worked in Washington. So I went into that meeting not expecting to see sheriff deputies tossing people in, you know, out of the hall. It was really, it was really absurd.
Yeah, you know, and they've been meeting at, I think, at that location. Well, the 2018 Dorchman meeting I went to was in that location, and that was, I think, when the party and related groups like that started meeting there. And it's kind of difficult to get there. It's off the beaten path a little bit. You kind of got to find your way back there to it. So, you know, really people that show up and attend really want to be there. And, you know, like the 2018 meeting was a pretty fair and open process. No one was excluded from the meeting other than a brief executive session they went into to just to talk over in private some of the endorsements, which they're certainly permitted to do. And they came back and they voted, but, you know, all the candidates had an opportunity to be present and make speeches and make arguments why they should or shouldn't be endorsed. But we've got a situation now where it doesn't look to me like they're even going to let candidates in to speak.
Yeah, it's and so just to, I think the main points of the lawsuit for me is that the committee members believe that their term was for the entire, I guess, 2 years, and they were put, the Central Committee itself voted to approve them on the committees, and the chairman cannot just throw people off a committee because he doesn't like them or what they're up to. And
that's correct.
And there are at least one or two motions in there about establishing an audit and just trying to get to some forensics, because it's my understanding that the books of the Ohio Republican Party are actually unauditable, and it seems like somebody made the decision that it was better to let the statute of limitations just run out than actually try to fix this thing. And also there's the clawback of funds that were not authorized to be dispensed by the party, by the committee. And, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe $1 million sent to both DeWine and I believe the Attorney General. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. And, you know, there's a process in place. Everything that the chairman would like to do, there is a process in place to do it. But you have to go to the members of the committee and ask their permission to do it, and they vote on it. The best example is on the primary process. There is a process within the bylaws. If you want to spend party funds on a candidate in the primary, there's a process. You go in there, you get the endorsement. You follow the process, and, you know, you have the expenditures go through the appropriate committees and get approved by the full committee, and, you know, you go like that. The chairman apparently is afraid to take any kind of vote. I'm guessing because he's afraid of potentially losing a vote, and if he loses a vote, maybe he thinks his chairmanship would be up. The problem is he's making a bad situation into a terrible situation. When your member starts suing you, something's wrong. You need to open up the process.
That's your first sign.
You need to open up the process.
That's your first sign of trouble, I think, Scott.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, let's wrap it up here. I really appreciate you coming on the Ohio Star podcast, Scott. Where can people find you on Twitter?
I'm at twitter.com / Scott Pullins. And then I'm all over Facebook and the web, scottpullins.com, scottpullins.org. Any of those sites will get to me.
All right. Fantastic, Scott. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
After the 2012 election, I wrote a piece for Human Events that pointed out that in the 2012 Ohio Republican primary, all of the counties won by Rick Santorum went to President Barack Obama in the general election, but most of the counties won by Mitt Romney went to Romney in the general. At the time, my point was that had Romney picked Santorum to run with him on the ticket, he would have carried Ohio, and by extension, other areas where Santorum was strong, like Upper Peninsula Michigan or Western Pennsylvania. This was all pre-Trump, so now we understand that Santorum in 2012 is what my father called an anticipatory figure. That is, that Santorum was not Trump, but anticipated Trump and Trumpism. Now so many of the once solid Democratic counties in Ohio are solidly Republican. And of course, Senator Romney has voted to impeach President Trump twice. I told you all of that so I could tell you this. This dynamic is the most significant shift in American politics since the Democrats took the black vote away from the party of Lincoln. And with that, here is my conversation with State Representative DJ Swearingen. DJ, how's it going?
It's going well. How about you?
Fantastic. Now, your district is one of the sort of classic examples of what's happened to the state of Ohio politically in the last 10 years. I remember very clearly when Mitt Romney tried very hard to win the state in 2012 and talked about, I was in meetings with where Romney campaign people were giving briefings, and they would talk about millions of doorknobs that they were knocking, all the phone calls they were making, and they were really slugging it out to win the state, and they lost the state. It was very close in 2012. And then Donald Trump wins the state twice, 2016, 2020, and it wasn't even close. And sort of, it seems that your district is part of that sort of pivot. It's I guess they're calling it the Obama Trump districts. Is it fair to say that you are in an Obama Trump district? And what have you seen from your the ground level?
Yeah, I think that's a really good description of my district, Neil, in the sense that it did vote for President Obama twice, once in 2008 and again in 2012. However, really since 2010, we have seen a swing to the Republican Party in my district. And I think you hit on a key point where President Trump's message really resonated with the people who lived in my district in terms of the America First policies, such as negotiating fair trade agreements, taking on China, reshoring some of our manufacturing capabilities and supply chains, as COVID highlighted the need for. That message in securing our border, that message really resonated with our communities. And, I think that's why you saw President Trump have success in our area. And I think that's why you've seen a lot of Republicans have success in our area. And since 2010 in Erie County specifically, we have not lost a contested race as a Republican Party, and Ottawa County has seen a lot of the same success to the point where, you had Ottawa County voting for President Obama and deemed a bellwether county to now voting 60% and above for Republican candidates. And this year, for instance, the two countywide officials in Ottawa County, they're not receiving any Democratic challengers. And the two countywide officials in Erie County, they're not receiving any Democratic challengers either. So I think you've seen a couple things where Republicans at the moment have the right message. It's resonating with voters. they've shown that they can lead when given the opportunity. And I think that's attractive to voters and previously Democratic counties. And, you know, when I was knocking doors myself, I can't tell you how many times I heard, I used to vote Democratic, but I'll never do it again. I'm voting Republican straight ticket this election cycle and future election cycle. So the tide is really changing in my district.
Yeah, I don't think Ohio's even a battleground state anymore.
No, I think what highlights that is the slated Democratic candidates that are fielded this year to take on the Republican statewide. You know, it was really a shallow pool that they were choosing from, and I think they had trouble finding people to step up. And, you know, and I think that was further highlighted by the fact that President Biden spent hardly any time in Ohio. His campaign was non-existent in the state of Ohio. And I think they know that Democratic message at the national level is not resonating with Ohio Republicans. Or just Ohioans for that.
And Brian Moreno, is he from your area?
Mr. Moreno is kind of from the Northeast. He's the west side of Cleveland, Westlake area. It's close. It is close to my district, though.
Yeah, and I just saw that he pulled out of the Senate race after meeting with President Donald J. Trump. And, you know, people in Washington or in national media talk about all the time about, you know, the need for the Republican Party to move on from Trump and the post-Trump Republican Party. But I think this shows, like, in the nuts and bolts level, President Trump is still very much not just the leader of the party, but he is actively managing the party to the good, I would argue.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like I alluded to earlier, there are a couple of things that I noticed that people really liked about President Trump, and those were, number one, his policies, especially on the trade issue. And for, you know, in the Midwest, you know, I don't agree with this label, but sometimes we wear the label of the Rust Belt, where we saw a lot of our jobs go overseas, a lot of our manufacturing capabilities overseas. And President Trump said, you know, we're not going to leave Midwestern Americans behind. You know, we need to find something for them to do that they can make a good wage off of and raise their families and buy a home and live the American dream. And I think that really resonated. And another thing that I think resonated as far as what President Trump was capable to do is he was not afraid to take a stand for what he thought was right. And that's attractive to a lot of voters, someone who will stand up and say, hey, I believe in this and I believe that this is the right thing to do. And we're going to go forward with this idea and this concept. So, you know, I think they also saw what he was able to get done in his first term. And as a result, you know, he earned the overwhelming vote of the state of Ohio.
And when it comes to issues like life and guns, having Trump being so out front on those issues, more so than any even more so than Ronald Reagan, it gives sort of confidence to people, other people, to speak up, you know, because, you know, with those kinds of issues, you know, because of the overwhelming message, cultural warfare coming from the left. And the left, you know, their allies in the media, you know, a lot of people are afraid to even say that they support gun rights or they're pro-life. But with Trump being out front there, that and other issues, it gives confidence to regular people to speak up.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I think being strong in your convictions is something that Americans have, you know, kind of ingrained in their DNA if you look throughout our history. But you know, you hit on a big thing where, you know, I have three daughters of my own. You know, I'm very pro-life. I've been to the ultrasounds with my wife, you know, and to protect innocent life is a key factor for our, it's a key plank for our party. But what you saw with President Trump, I mean, I believe he was the first president to attend the March for Life.
Yes.
And I've attended the March for Life a couple times with my wife. But the president was never there. And I think for the president to actually be at the March for Life, which is a huge event in Washington, D.C., I mean, that just speaks volumes to you know, his propensity to stand for his convictions and what he believes, and, you know, not only say the words that he's pro-life, but to show that he's pro-life and show up to the March for Life and show up to those types of events. And I think, again, people find that actions do speak louder than words, and those behaviors, again, really resonated and were appreciated by a lot of voters.
And last thing, DJ, is, you know, there's an issue that's particular to your district, and that's Line 5, which goes between Michigan and Toledo, if I got that correct. So you've talked about, describe for people what Line 5 is about and why, who's trying to disrupt it and jam it up?
Yeah, this is a very similar issue. We've seen pipelines all over the United States come under attack from this current administration. But Enbridge Line 5 takes oil through Michigan to our Toledo refineries. Now, Toledo's not specifically in my district. It's just outside to the west of it. But these refineries are pivotal to Toledo's economy. A lot of men and women have good-paying jobs at these refineries. And Line 5 is the lifeblood to these refineries. And right now, it's under attack by the Michigan Attorney General and the governor, saying that it's somehow an environmental threat. Now, keep in mind, the company itself, Enbridge, has offered to lay a whole new line entirely. It's offered to do so in an environmentally safe and friendly way. So, you know, based off of that, it just tells me that this is all about, you know, an attack on our domestic oil supply, like we've seen elsewhere around the country. But we need to keep that line open. You know, we've done a few things in the Ohio legislature to support that cause. We hope that, you know, we're successful in keeping that line five open. You know, not only do a lot of men and women have good paying jobs at these refineries, you know, those refineries obviously create our domestic supply of gasoline. And I think everyone can agree that we do not want to become foreign dependent for our gasoline and oil and everything like that. So, you know, to keep these pipelines open, to keep them operational is great for our state. It's great for our consumers. And, you know, it's actually a bipartisan issue where we were able to get some Democratic support on that, which was nice. But as usual, that line is under attack right now, and we need to defend it and keep it open.
Well, you know, and you also have a situation where what is the, you know, the alternative might be, you know, transporting oil and fuel by train. And anybody right. who's ever seen, you know, the fires and the destruction of what's happened when there's an accident and something goes very, very wrong. And then, of course, you know, it also jams up our rail lines. Anybody who's been stuck, if anybody's wondered why, like, their Amtrak might be backed up or other trains might be backed up going cross country, it's because of, you know, so much of this, so much of our fuel is being carried on the rails, and it's jamming up our capacity.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, these pipelines provide a very reliable, very safe way of transporting oil from, you know, one place to the next. And it's something that we have a vested interest in keeping open for a number of reasons. I'm hopeful that we are able to keep Line 5 open, and you know, we're going to keep fighting towards that end in Ohio.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be writing about Line 5 for the Ohio Star and keeping track of what's going on. And in the future, when it's appropriate, I'd like to talk to you about redistricting. In the meantime, DJ, where can people find you on social media?
I'm on Twitter, and, you know, it's funny, Neil, I'm not a big social media fan. I just think social media these days has become more toxic than good, but I am out there. If you want to follow me on Twitter, my Twitter is at DJ Swearge. So at DJ SWEARG89, and then same State Representative DJ Swearinge, and I have a page on Facebook. If you want to follow along there, feel free to do so.
I was talking to my brother the other day about Twitter being so toxic, and we both agree that Twitter is toxic, and that's why we're there.
it's something, Neil. It's like, it's just so much. People say things on social media that they would never say to your face in real life. I mean, and that's the truth. And so much more gets accomplished sitting around the table with a cup of coffee, hashing it out, eyeball to eyeball, than, you know, these Twitter wars that we see today that are just kind of, you know, they're distractions, in my opinion. And hey, I'm not saying I'm innocent from engaging in a few myself every now and then, but, you know, I just have to sit back and wonder what our culture would be like, you know, when we just sat around the table and sometimes walked away shaking hands, agreeing to disagree. But unfortunately, that's not the world we're living in these days.
Thank you for joining me on the Ohio Star podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our weekly programs that drop Thursdays. And also, please remember to leave a positive review on iTunes or wherever you're hearing me now, because it helps other people find the podcast. I am Reporter McCabe on Twitter, and you can send me news tips at neilwmccabe@thestarnewsnetwork.com. Until next time, this is Neil W. McCabe reporting for the Ohio Star.